show.
Welcome to this week's edition of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and I have with me in the studio four guys, Steve, Mott, and Ted. Oh, no, just three guys. Sorry. Bad math. I was an English major. Sorry.
Well, it's all that weight we've gained.
The Lord. Hello, the MP mic. So, anyway, we are here to talk about an interesting and fascinating topic. But before that, I will go ahead and just run down this week's show. We're going to start out by talking about how guys can marry well. So, women, if you don't think guys do, listen. Guys, if you don't know how to, listen. And if anyone disagrees with what I just said, listen and then write to us and disagree with me. So that is important. We're also going to hear for the first time, I think, on The Boundless Show from Gary Thomas, who is a very prominent marriage expert in the world of Christendom. And he's going to be talking about that decade for men that is very pivotal as far as making the trip towards marriage. Later on in the show, Aaron Carman's going to be giving us some lessons from the cafeteria, and we're going to wrap up with the inbox and how we juggle commitments and what does that mean as a single person. So stay tuned for all of that. But here we are with the three Boundless guys to talk about an ebook that is currently online on our site, boundless.org, called The Guy's Guide to Marrying Well. So I'm assuming that in writing this ebook, which incidentally is only 60 pages and is free, so everyone should be downloading it right now to either read themselves and or hand out to someone they know. I'm assuming that because you guys wrote this, it means that it is possible.
Absolutely. Possible, but also of interest that there are 70% of guys who leave high school say that it's extremely important to them that they be able to marry well and have a family, which surprises a lot of us, but that desire is there. And in other studies, we see that they are more likely to believe that you should get married than to spend the rest of your life single than women are. And that there are more of them, that there are a million more Christian never married men out there than Christian never married women. All these things surprise people, but the reality, it's a desire most guys have. Unfortunately, it's a lot like their desire to get rich and retire on their dream property someday. It's something they've got a heart for, but not necessarily good coaching, good instruction for. More of the guys that we interact with are coming from broken homes, don't have any good coaches, mentors, other people in their lives. They're not getting good instruction. And so there's a big gap between their heart's desire and how to actually pull it off. Our desire is to come along and provide some of those details, to fill it in. And that's what we've done with this Guy's Guide to Marrying Well. And we want to create it in such a way that it's easy and free for them to get. And so if you just go to boundless.org/guys, it's right there, free and available for anyone.
Okay, that's good. And I think this is helpful because wouldn't you think it seems to be a little quirky that we now in this day and age have to write guides? I mean, I know that most of it, you know, I think a lot of these guys are like, it's a cultural norm. They're expecting marriage. They want to be married. I think they are honest in their pursuit, but it is kind of one of those, how do you make it happen? And I think so many of us, you know, me and talking to my parents, honestly, my mom went to some of my dad's basketball games and the next thing they knew they were married. And it didn't seem, they didn't need a book. Like, why do we need books? I mean, it's honestly, it's like we're in this quagmire of weirdness, you know, in this decade.
Well, something you'll notice in so many men's magazines right now is that the popularity of the how-to feature, that it's making a comeback in a big way. And I really do think it's because a lot of guys out there have a desire to know it, but no one's ever wrapped an arm around them and said, this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. They just didn't get good modeling, didn't get good instruction. And unfortunately, a lot of our churches don't teach this stuff. And so there is a gap out there. And I think a lot of the advice guys are getting is spectacularly bad. And so it's our desire to get in front of them some of the best principles that have proven really do help men marry well.
Okay. Well, you guys talk about in this ebook, and again, it is called The Guy's Guide to Marrying Well, you talk about four principles and you kind of break it down into things that really are not only scripturally necessary, but practical. They are things that guys can latch onto and say, whoa, this is something I can write down, I can get help in, I can evaluate myself and where I am in this situation. And they are intentionality, community, Christian compatibility, and purity. So let's kind of break each one of these down. We've talked a lot about intentionality here on Boundless, but why don't you guys summarize for a guy who says, I told you I want to get married and, you know, I saw this girl and we went out, you know, whatever. What does that mean? I mean, when you're talking about intentionality, what are we really talking about?
Well, I think biblically, men are to lead and women respond in marriage. And that applies to dating as well. If a man cannot initiate and take on the risk of rejection in initiating a dating relationship, then that says something about how he's going to lead in marriage, probably. A man in marriage is going to lead spiritually. He's going to lead in decisions about career and parenting and other things. So a man needs to show leadership on the other side of marriage as well in a dating relationship. And there's a great article in there on that, and it puts it right out there for men. And this article from Michael Lawrence, when he says, so some men are thinking at this point, says, are you saying that the risk is mine? Well, yes, the risk is yours. Doesn't that mean that she can just tell me no and leave me twisting in the wind? Yes, it does. Welcome to leadership.
And the good news about this is that it pays off, that it does help men marry well. Every time you hear a speaker say, I married up, that's a guy who took a risk, who actually looked at someone and thought, boy, that's probably marrying up, but I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to initiate. The guys who aren't willing to take that initiative don't tend to marry well.
Mm-hmm. And that leads into another section about the Christian compatibility that talks about attraction, marrying up.
That's right. In Christian compatibility, if you think about your desire is to marry well, there are a dozen organizations out there who give you a formula, who will tell you, you come to our site, we're going to match you based on astrological sign and birth order and, you know, favorite pizza flavors or whatever. And you can come up with all kinds of reasons to think somebody's a good or a bad fit. What we're trying to land on is, what are the specific things that really make a good Christian match? What are things that help people discern that they'd be better together than apart, that they really do have something that is marriage potential there? And I think people would be surprised to realize it's a lot simpler than you would think, but those simple principles can make all the difference between a good marriage and a bad marriage.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you're saying, when we're talking now then about Christian compatibility, what are some of the cornerstone things that you need to have?
Well, we really focus on this idea of, one, are they a believer? Are you equally yoked? Are you in the same spiritual weight class? But also, is this someone with whom you are both prepared to live out the job description of what you would see in Ephesians 5 about what a Christian marriage looks like? And that's why it's Christian compatibility, not just your ability to be compatible with anyone. It's your ability to be married to this person and have a Christian marriage. So that's really at the bedrock of it. But also, it's just a lot of good principles in there enabling guys to discern, how can I know that this is a good fit? And that kind of leads to the community piece, because one of the key pieces in identifying Christian compatibility is saying, what is your family saying? What are your mentors saying, your friends? And that's a key piece, because we're not always objective. We don't always discern rightly ourselves. And so it's encouraging those mentor relationships. It's encouraging church attendance and being plugged into a body to get that level of feedback and accountability you need.
Well, Steve, that reminds me of how my most successful relationship came about, the one I'm in now. Our singles pastor told me, Ted, we were talking about Ashley, Ted, just marry her. He knew both of us. He had seen us interact. He knew our character. And he just said, Ted, just marry her. And that kind of input, that kind of confident input from somebody that I really respected, gave me just the nudge enough to really pursue with intentionality in the context of this church community.
Well, and two, I think some of our listeners will remember Ted's story. One of the ways that Ted was able to actually have some sense of clarity about the relationship with Ashley is that they also, in the realm of accountability and community, said, let's be pure. Let's be as pure as possible so that our decision won't be distracted by a physical relationship taking over the inertia. And so even though everybody's heard they shouldn't have sex before marriage and all these reasons why they shouldn't, I'm constantly amazed by how many people are just scratching their head and say, I'm just so confused and addled about this relationship. And then you find out they're having sex, and they shouldn't be surprised that the physical has taken over the mental and the spiritual discerning capabilities. And so that's one of the key things we hit at in this purity section, is how can you really be clear by following God's principles so that you really can make a wise choice and marry well instead of just letting your hormones make the decision for you.
And community plays an important role in the purity of a couple because it provides a level of protection for the woman if a man is under the accountability of other men.
Absolutely.
And
well, and our section on purity also jumps in on the issue that a lot of guys listening will have dealt with, which is internet temptations, that a lot of marriages aren't formed well now because all the life and energy of the relationship has been sucked out by online temptations and struggles. And so there's a great piece in there by Al Mohler that I think is going to be very helpful for giving guys a new framework for how they can live and stay pure in accountability.
Yeah, because God meant for sex to call us out of ourselves, and pornography is the exact opposite. It's moving inward, and it's self-focus for and self-gratifying. And that, if you are involved in pornography or you're struggling with pornography, that's going to harm your relationship. That's going to harm your marriage.
Yeah, I think guys would be encouraged by this, that they're going to read into some of these principles and think, well, it kind of sounds like what my Sunday school teacher used to say or whatever. But I'm hoping they'll recognize as we deliver this. I mean, it's engaging, it's humorous, but most importantly, this is stuff that works. You do this, and it gives you the ability to cut through all of the clutter out there about relationships and marriage and all this psychobabble and therapeutic stuff, to realize God knew what he was saying when he gave us a few basic principles about how you're supposed to lead, how you're supposed to be in community, how you're supposed to be pure about it, and how you're supposed to marry someone to whom you're equally yoked. And it works, and you get to marry well, and it's the desire of most of men's hearts. And I think this will be an encouraging piece for them.
Okay. Well, good. Well, I think we'll maybe have to come back in future roundtables and do a short series that tackles each of these principles individually, because they're, like we said on the front end, you know, I think we have a lot of cultural clutter to cut through and stuff that has been done badly and stuff that's been modeled badly. And so in order to counter that, I think there's a lot of that in and of itself is going to need community effort on the part of these guys and the women that they're ultimately going to date, because I think that there could be everything from self-delusion out there to just misapplication to the women who probably have bad attitudes towards these men as a result and may not be receptive, and they need to be open to that too. So again, it's called The Guide's Guide to Marrying Well. Go to boundless.org and you can download it for free. It's about 60 pages. It is an ebook, and get started on it. Maybe we can have people read it, and then we can base some, we can start fielding some questions that people have off of the content and go from there as well. So, but we do want to go and tackle some of this stuff individually as well. So we hope to do that now in the near future. If in the meantime you have questions, or as you're reading the book, you do, or you have something that you want us to clarify, if we can do that in the context of an upcoming roundtable, we'd love to do that. So write to us at editor@boundless.org or give us a call, 1-866-687-8686, and we will do our best to address any of that and make this a great discussion.
Well, I drove down south to Georgia's Peach and made my way through Memphis, Tennessee. Spoke to her father about taking her hand, but now she is here with me. Some might say you took her way too fast, but I say when you know, you just know. Some might say that this will never last, but I say she is good as gold. Well, I drove down south and took Georgia's Peach and made my way through Memphis, Tennessee. And I spoke to her father about taking her hand, and now she is here with me.
In this week's culture segment, Candace and Steve sit down with marriage expert Gary Thomas to talk about that decisive decade for guys.
Today we have a very special guest in the studio with us. Steve is here with me, and we're talking to Gary Thomas, who is a best-selling author of such titles as Sacred Marriage, Sacred Parenting, Sacred Influence, and his most recent book that we've talked about on Boundless is The Beautiful Fight. Gary, it's really good to have you here today.
Thank you, Candace.
Well, we heard a message that you gave you sent us a CD, and so last summer we were driving to Denver and popped the CD in the audio player and heard this fantastic message about the decisive decade. And that's really what we want to focus on today, because so many of you listening are in your 20s. And so we want to have Gary give you some of his best stuff for right where you're at, right where you're living. And so what is it about the 20s that make that decade decisive?
Well, I go back even a little bit further. I really call the decisive decade 16 to 28. I know that's 12 years, but
you got a math
decisive
problem.
Decade sounds better than decisive.
It's like a baker's decade.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. but here's why. That's really the decade that sets somebody up in this sense. It'll either be a springboard for a really influential, powerful life, or it'll be a hurdle they have to try to overcome for the rest of their life. So if we're talking to some 27, 28-year-olds and they feel like they've really blown it, it doesn't mean your life is toast. It just means that you have made things more difficult for yourself and you need to realize that. And by that, I mean virtually every major decision you make is made in that decade. Who you marry. The average guy gets married at 28 now. How big of a role God's going to have in your life. Your education, whether that's setting you up for a vocation that's satisfying or not. Your health habits, whether you're going to be pushing toward addiction or you're going to have the energy of a healthy life. How you're going to handle substances that could really bring you down, like alcohol, or whether you're going to be, you know, just somebody that doesn't set themselves up for a lot of health problems in their 50s. And 60s. And so it's really such, I think, such a key decade. And the temptation is that our culture lets 16 and 17-year-olds just still be kids. But 16 and 17-year-olds are making decisions that really will either set them up or hold them back. And I'm saying this as a father of an 18-year-old. There was a school that Graham really wanted to go to that he did get accepted to and got to go into. I remember walking on it when he was a junior in high school. And I told him, "Bud, you've made some great choices, and because of that, you can go here." And we went to another school that was sort of the second choice. If we can't get into that, this school. And the guy admitted, you know, for my first few years of high school, I just really wasn't that serious about it. So by the time I was a senior and thought I really should think about where I want to go, I had already limited myself. Huh. And so it's really trying to see this as a decade where you really want to set yourself up for the life that comes.
You know, it's a term I hear a lot is that people believe they're living in the eternal now, mm-hmm. that they don't really see their lives as a chapter or as right. a segment that's going to have, you know, any bearing on another segment. It's just right. they're continuing to live in the season they're in. And so I like this idea of reminding people that it is a season, and that for better or worse, it's going to make a difference. And that even while people say, oh, 30 is the new 20, and you've got this much longer to figure it out, that how you spend that time actually does make a difference.
Yeah.
And so I was just curious, what examples have you seen of those who have thought they were living in the eternal now, having that wake-up call of realizing, I guess it did matter how I spent that time?
I just spoke at a men's retreat down in Oregon. And I guess it's up in Oregon from here, down in Oregon from where I live. But 1,800 men are there. And I have found pretty clearly when I'm talking to a large group of men, and this is going to shock some of the listening guys here, but I want them to hear this. I don't want it to scare them, but I want it to motivate them. My estimate is that about 85% of men, including Christian men, are very frustrated in their vocations. They've fallen into their jobs because it's what they have to do to pay the bills. It's not what they imagined doing. It's not what they dreamed of doing. And most of those men will admit there was some point in their 20s where they were passive or they wasted time. They didn't take advantage. And then they got themselves into a situation. They got themselves into debt. They got married. They had a kid where they just had to do what would bring the money in. And that has set them up many times for the rest of their life trying to overcome that passivity. So I've seen the negative examples. I've said to my son, I want you to really enjoy your life. And so use a little discipline here in your late teens and early 20s so that you can choose where you vacation, that you can look forward to going to work rather than try to live for retirement by the time you turn 42. Because it's a frightening prospect to think about.
That's a good point.
So how are most 20-somethings doing? Are they setting themselves up for springboards or for hurdles? I mean, the 20-somethings you encounter.
I see hurdles, to be honest. And I'm empathetic for it because that's a tough decade. 16 to 28, you're being prodded, you're being tested, you're being evaluated. You're coming up out of adolescence into adulthood. And so there's a lot of pressure. There really is. And Satan's temptation, I believe, is to get young men to respond to pressure with passivity. You know, don't really worry about a vocation. just try to become nationally ranked on Halo 3. You know, I mean, that's your aim. Don't really worry about trying to find a godly woman, because Satan knows there is nothing that compares to being married to a godly woman. The way you set yourself up for life by having a godly woman next to you is hard to overstate. It's just incredible. Instead, just make dating all about recreation. Did you have a good time with her? Are you getting further than you hope? I mean, it's turning dating into either a sexual experience or a recreational experience. It's not really about finding a really good partner for life. And yet I talk to men who are married to godly women, and I can't tell you how grateful they are. And I've talked to a lot of middle-aged men married to women that were the cheerleaders and everything that guys often look for early on, that are still narcissistic, that are still selfish, that are and you know what? It's a hurdle in life. Rather than their marriage being a springboard that is really helping them fulfill what they want to do, a lot of times it's a big drain.
How much does expectations play a part? We hear that people just have low expectations for people in that decade, that period of time.
Well, I think that that's a large part of it. But I even see expectations from a different perspective. I think as Christians, there's this laziness that is confused with faith. God will open the door. You know, I'm just, and people do that, Candace. We've talked about this, what I like in your book, about how some people say, well, God will just bring the right partner along, which is what I really like about your book, Get Married, which we would never do. I mean, no guy ever says that he's expecting Harvard to call him up and say, hey, heard you did pretty good in high school. Why don't you apply? I think we've got a place for you. And you don't come out of college thinking Xerox or Microsoft is going to say, hey, you know, a professor told us you're going to be a good employee. Come work for us. In every other area of life, there's this sense of guys planning, making it happen, beating down the doors. And when I've shared in some of my own writing, to become a writer, what I went through makes me shudder now. It was an 8-year process of rejection. When I read biographies of U2, biographies of the Beatles, biographies of guys who really made it, in most instances, these were guys that just kept, you know, just hitting their heads up against the wall, and they didn't quit.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys just have this sense that God's going to open the door, and so they think they can just give it a half-baked effort. This isn't a world where half-baked efforts go very far.
Yeah. Now, you also have 2 daughters, and so as a father, are you talking to your daughters differently than your son about what decisiveness looks like? Are there any distinctions for men and women?
Well, I've talked to them on 2 different levels. One, about how to relate to today's guys, because I'm not painting all the listener guys in this light, but there does tend to be, I think most people can say, a passivity in this generation amongst guys that wasn't quite there in previous years. And so it's, how do they learn to relate to guys in that mold and maybe hopefully inspire them, but really then setting themselves up. You know, I'm seeing gifts in each one of them where I can say to them, I can really see you doing this, and how does that fit in with your desire to be a wife and a mom and where you're headed. So, yeah, I'm trying to get them to set themselves up as well. So those issues are the same as far as health habits.
Right.
You know, how they eat, how they deal with the substances, the drugs, alcohol, all of that, the smoking, the place that God's going to have in their life, whether dating's recreational or whether it's really a time of finding a good partner. Those issues are the same for women as for men.
Now, are you seeing something different among women? Because here at Focus, at the Institute, on Boundless, we just see a lot of very motivated women leapfrogging the guys academically and in their career paths.
Well, and the demographics bear that out. Colleges are really having problems because a lot of them are trying to keep the number of women below 65%, which, you do the math, that's 2 to 1. And they're having a hard time doing it in some places and in some schools. Women do seem to be more motivated in this day and age in just about every sphere, in politics, in literature, in journalism, you name it, that is true.
Is that an even bigger disincentive for the guys? I mean, how do they respond in that kind of environment?
Well, I don't know if they're responding to that. It just seems to me that there seems to be more passive temptations for men. The whole video game mentality, the just sense that some of them just revel in this life of, they almost sanctify the sense of not being too hard driving. And it's not like there's something wrong with recreation. Right. I'm not completely against video games. In fact, to be honest, sometimes I would try to encourage my son to do some more downtime things. I would applaud him when he was playing Madden 07 or that time because I thought, you know, he's been working hard, and I think you do need to teach the value and the worth of play. The problem is when play becomes your life instead of relaxation from your calling.
So are you speaking to a lot of 20-something guys, and are they responding well to your message? What's the interplay or the interaction there like?
I don't know that I can gauge the response that well. I've been speaking to a number of churches. I just spoke at the men's retreat. I'm telling you, the dads are loving it. Dads that were there with their sons were coming up. This is exactly what my son needed to hear. We're going to have this conversation on the way home. I'm just trying to be honest. I'm not sure how many young men have come up to me and have really mentioned whether they're wrestling with this issue.
Unless the Lord build the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord guard the city, the watchmen wake in vain. In vain you rise up early and then retire late to eat the fruit of grief and the bread.
Welcome to this week's The Hungry Years, where Erin Carmen tells us the lesson she learned in the cafeteria.
I was 16 years old and a junior in high school. The day was no different than any other day, you know, where I tried not to be awkward as I wandered the halls of the teen social prison called Liberty High School. I was heading to the lunchroom to join my normal table of girlfriends. The halls were filled with my fellow inmates as I turned to descend the giant staircase that led into the cafeteria, when who do I see coming down the stairs towards me? Jason Hendricks. It was like the heavens opened up and the angelic choirs were singing. Jason was a blonde-haired, computer genius, soccer god with a 4.0. In terms of heartthrobs, for me, it doesn't get any better than the geek-jock combo. We'd been pretty good friends since freshman year, but little did he know that I would have given up my entire collection of New Kids on the Block tapes if he'd asked me out. As he climbed the stairs towards me, I prepared myself to unleash my feminine wiles on him in hopes of giving him some sort of signal that if he wanted to ask me to homecoming, I was definitely not going to say no. "Hey, Jason," I said. "Hey, Erin," he replied with a smile. His smile should have been licensed as a lethal weapon for turning unsuspecting girls like myself into piles of goo. My mind was racing. "Think of something witty. Think of something witty." "How's it going?" "Good," he says. "Think of something flirty. Think of something flirty." "Cool. Did you finish that AP bio project?" "Yeah, you heading to lunch?" he asked. "Yeah," I stuttered. He said, "Cool. I'll see you in English." "See ya," I said, and he turned to go. As I watched my personal David Beckham / Bill Gates climb those last two stairs, I thought to myself, "Awesome, Erin. Nothing says please, please, please ask me to homecoming like talking about your biology homework." As I stared at the object of my obsession and continued my descent down the staircase, I missed a step. And ate it. This was no cute little stumble over your shoelaces moment. This was an epic free fall down an entire flight of stairs. Luckily, there were other students there to absorb my fall because I definitely would have broken some limbs as I flew end over end to the bottom. Silence filled the cafeteria. Until I hear Jason's voice from the top of the stairs.
Are you okay?
As I laid face down in my puddle of shame, I tried to see the bright side and thanked God that I'd changed my mind that morning about wearing a dress to school. I heaved myself off the floor, dusted off my jeans, and raised my hands over my head in my best impression of Carrie Strug sticking her landing, and announced to my audience, I'm good. Nothing to see here. Go back to your business. Avoiding Jason's worried look, I dashed to the bathroom where I spent the entire lunch period bawling and counting my bruises. I ditched English that day. Jason never did ask me to homecoming, and to make this story ever more tragic, he told me 2 years after we graduated that he had been interested in me for a year and really wanted to ask me to the dance, but was too chicken because he thought I would say no. This memory has always stuck with me. I mean, besides the obvious reason of it possibly being the most humiliating thing to happen to a teen girl, as I've grown as a Christian, I've always seen it as a vivid representation of what happens to me when I get distracted from the important things in life. Worldly desires, men, job, success, money, attention, what have you. If you obsess over any of these things long enough, you're bound to, one, eat it. You're gonna stumble and fall. Two, be humbled. Three, not make it to what I like to call the Lord's lunch table. And four, be left counting your bruises. It reminds me of what my dad used to say when he was teaching me how to drive. Aaron, keep your eyes on where you're going.
One thing I have asked of the Lord, that I may dwell in his house all my days, to gaze upon the beauty of Jehovah Almighty, and to seek him in his temple always.
Opening up this week's inbox, I'm here in the studio with Steve Waters. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey. This is really a fascinating question. I am so impressed by the breadth of questions that we get from people, because sometimes I just think, wow, I wouldn't have even thought of that, and I definitely want to know the answer. So listen up, folks. Here it is. This is fascinating. She says, this is from Amy. I'm a single woman with a college degree working in a job I'm not passionate about and definitely don't want to keep much longer. I want to be in full-time ministry and I want to move closer to my family in California. My problem is that I've already committed to volunteering as a junior high small group leader at my church for the rest of the school year. My question is, how do we as young single people trying to enter the workforce handle commitments during these transitional seasons? Do we just not make any commitments?
Well, Amy, the short answer is no. You need to make commitments. And the fact is, young adults are notorious for not making commitments. I mean, I've talked to so many people who say, my roommates won't even commit to whether or not we're going to pull together to make a meal tonight or if we're going to go out to eat. I mean, there needs to be some predictability and trust that comes. And making and keeping commitments are your currency of trust. And adulthood is all about making these commitments. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is that make some commitments and then life will start to give you some answers. And so commitments are important. But I think what I hear in your tone is this concern about how commitments lock you in and how you may, because you made commitments and your conscience is telling you, I need to keep this commitment, you might get stuck in a bad situation. And so you're thinking, do I just stoically go through it and hold my nose and just do it because I made a commitment, I got to be faithful. And that's where I appreciate a principle I heard of that encourages people, you either need to keep your commitments or renegotiate your commitments. And you don't want to constantly be renegotiating them. You want to go into them wisely on the front end and then hold on to them as strong as you can. But when it becomes obvious that there's now a clash, that it's no longer a win-win, it's not what it looked like it was going to be in the beginning, or, you know, in the case of Amy, if you've got an opportunity to be back closer to family or whatever it is, that's when you go back and you say, we made this commitment. However, this is what's changed. And I want to be a person of my word. I want to show some integrity, but I want to see if we can renegotiate this commitment. The last thing you want to do is either just stoically go through it and give people a lousy contribution because you just feel like you got to be faithful about it, or that you just not show up and they don't even know what happened because you didn't renegotiate it. So my short answer is make commitments and keep commitments when you can, but when you have to, renegotiate and then keep the renegotiated commitment.
Mm-hmm. Amy, I would just add here that it's valuable to look at this in context of really what we're talking about here. I mean, it's, you know, what I find is, and many of my peers don't want to make commitments because they have this elusive, like if you're saying, you know, I would like to change careers. Well, if you don't think that's really going to happen realistically right in the next 3 months, you probably can help the junior high program out for the rest of the school year, you know? And I think so much of, you know, so many of us in this life stage, we just don't even want to put out the possibility there that something may be happening. And so, you know, I think anyone will tell you, I mean, these the people in charge of your youth program at church, if you find out that you have a job and it's out of state, people can flex around that. That is for real. But if right. you want to drop a commitment because you're tired or you want to hang out with your new hot boyfriend or whatever, that is an issue that probably has to be addressed at more of a root, you know, root situation.
Yeah, but you need commitments to bring structure to your life. And, mm-hmm. and at a season where everything seems open and possible, instead of just viewing that as, therefore, let's not make any commitments, what's probably smarter is just be even more careful about the commitments you go into. Maybe keep them short term so that you do have flexibility for opportunities that come up. But definitely don't solve the problem by not making commitments, because that's what the next season of your life is really all about, is the growth that's going to come from making and keeping commitments.
Exactly. And I will say my danger is definitely in overcommitting, but I would certainly encourage anyone out there who is consistently following 6 or more television shows a week, and you know who you are, drop some of them and pick up some healthier commitments.
And to add some advice that I got from a mentor of mine, every year review all your commitments and ask, is this still a good commitment? Is this still thriving and growing and helpful on both sides of the commitment, so that you don't just keep stockpiling and then you realize you're no longer effective because you've overcommitted?
Right. That's true. All right. That is it for this week's Inbox and for the show itself. Wow, we've had quite a roundup of stuff to talk about today. So again, we will be revisiting the whole idea of men marrying well. So stay tuned for that. And we'll be previewing that in the coming weeks. And as always, if you have questions for us or feedback, something for the Inbox, we want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org or give us a call 1-866-687-8686. Some of you have asked me questions on my Facebook page, which is fantastic, but we'd love to hear them actually here at Boundless so we can actually address them as a team, because I'm not wise enough for all of you just on my own. So anyway, that is fantastic, though. That is it for this week's show. Steve and the team, thanks for being here. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Until next time, have a great week, and we'll see you back soon.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.